RA Exchange. Welcome to Resident Advisors Exchange. I'm Chloe Lula, the Exchange's senior producer. This week, I'm going to keep my intro short and hand it over to RA senior editor Naishka Chandran, who writes our RA Pro newsletter and focuses her work on the economics of the dance music industry. In this interview, she talks to Nabil Ayers, a journalist, podcast host, and the U.S. president of Beggars Group, the home of independent labels 4AD, Matador Records, Rough Trade, XL, and Young. And yes, for anyone wondering, he also happens to be the late Roy Ayers' son. He expertly articulates the economic issues that plague the industry and the rigorous work his organization, the Organization for Recorded Culture and Arts, or ORCA, has done to address these shortcomings from the top down.
What we're doing and what we're trying to do, it supports a much larger community that extends far beyond even the albums that we sell or stream. It extends into the live business and record stores and record pressing plants. And there's really this long chain of people who benefit from artists making records and us putting them out. And so we really want to put that out there, do that research, and allow people to use it to hopefully make decisions.
This is a must-listen episode for anyone interested in what a better functioning music ecosystem could look like and the role of independent labels in 2025 and beyond. So stay tuned.
Welcome to The Exchange, Nabil.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you've been in the music industry for a very long time. Before Beggars, you were a general manager at 4AD. You co-founded the iconic Seattle record store, Sonic Boom. You've launched your own labels, and you still find the time to write about music for Pitchfork and the New York Times.
Occasionally.
Based on your experience from looking at the industry from a big picture perspective, what would you say are the biggest issues facing artists, labels, and distributors today?
There's one thing in that long list of things that you didn't include, which is that I also played drums in bands for a long time. And so that, to me, is sort of important to that question, because I've been on the artist side, played in bands for a long time. And I think even then, in the 90s when I was in bands, in the 2000s, and especially now, money has always been maybe the thing, if not something that's at the top of the list of issues and things that are hard for artists and labels and kind of everybody in the music industry. That's my number one answer, money.
Is there a particular kind of money that, as an artist or label, because you've been on both sides, that you would prefer? Is it public funding? Is it, you know, do you care where the money is coming from?
That's interesting. I mean, for me in particular, with any of those hats on, not necessarily. I mean, I think most people would love to think that it's coming from fans somehow, directly or indirectly, from the people who are enjoying the music, benefiting from it, sharing it, and therefore paying for it in some way, and that the people who are making it and helping putting it out in the world are also benefiting from that. That's the very sort of altruistic version. But, you know, so, as someone, especially in the band days, but even now as a label person, looking at countries like Canada and Australia and some European countries who have much more robust sort of government agencies and ways to help artists kind of get ahead and actually perform and make a living as musicians and artists. That is really impressive, and something that it doesn't not exist in America, but it's few and far between. I don't know anyone who's benefited from that here. I'm sure there are people who have, but that's something that I feel like is missing.
I think the interest from fans is there to support artists and labels, but it doesn't really translate through streaming or actual sales.
And it's hard. I mean, there is so much music. And on the upside, it's never been easier to get that music out into the world. When I was 20 years old and played in a band, you know, we could spend a lot of money to go to a recording studio, which certainly cost more than it does now, or at least more than how easy it is to record an album at home or without a studio now, and then press CDs. And then still, even at that point, if you were one of those lucky bands who could make your own CD and sell it at shows, you couldn't get it in stores. You certainly couldn't get it to everyone around the world. And so there's this real barrier to entry. And now that doesn't exist. Now you could make an album and it could be on a bunch of streaming services this week and everyone in the world could hear it. Someone could share it. It could blow up. All these incredible things could happen, and they do happen, but they don't happen to everyone. They still happen to a very small number. And there are people, of course, who can try to influence those things, and that can only go so far. But it's impossible for everyone to get through, but everyone wants to get through. And
everyone wants to get paid.
Everyone wants to get paid. Yes. So that's part of what's hard about it, is that there are so many people in the mix. And in a lot of ways, that's a good thing, but it's not a good thing financially.
So talk to us how money kind of made you join forces with your peers at Ninja Tune and K7 and Secretly and all the other labels that are part of Orca.
Yeah, I mean, Orca's a really interesting organization because it's, in a way, it's very casual. We're not members. We call ourselves supporters. There's not bylaws or anything like that, but it's a group of like-minded labels. And to be clear, they're all independent labels who are mostly owned by their founders and, you know, run by the people who started them. And we've been around, some of them, for decades. Beggars is going into 49 years next year, which is crazy. And all of these labels make investments in artists. We sign artists. We put out multiple records. We work with them for a long time. And I think we just started to realize we put so much into this and we love what we do. We work with artists we love. We're lucky to do that. And of course, we pay them when we try to support them. I mean, the very simple how I explain to, you know, my mother's friends what I do when I say I run a record company is it's really basic. It's, you know, we find things we love, we invest in them, both resources and money and time and effort and all those things, and we try to get the money back and pay it out. And it's kind of that simple. And that hasn't really changed since the beginning of recorded music. Of course, the medium has changed and what gets to people has changed, but the general concept is the same. And so this is a group of people who all believe pretty strongly that that is what we do really well. That's not to say other systems don't work. We are not against the majors. We are not against, you know, one artist putting out their own record, but what we do is uniquely different than that. And we wanted to get together and talk about that and explain that to people because we believe that outside of the music industry, a lot of people just don't understand what it even means to be an independent label, and we would like them to.
I want to go back to some of the point you raised earlier about, you know, how lack of funding or money is the big issue. How does money tie into Orca's mandate?
Well, what we're doing is we've hired the CME, the Center for Music Ecosystems, to do research. So essentially, Orca is a research organization. The first paper that we put out that's online, anybody can go look at and read, is basically, this is who we are, this is why we're doing this. There's not a ton in there. But the papers to come will be more research-based. I think what we would like to do is say, this is what it means to put out a record by a small artist for us, a medium artist for us, and a large artist for us. I'm kind of riffing right now, but something like that. Something that can explain to a layperson or, you know, somebody in policy or business or politics or the corporate world, someone not in the music industry who we want to understand what we do. So in terms that they can understand and say, it's not just somebody who records a song at home and has a TikTok hit and streams a bunch of music. That happens and that's great. But what we're doing and what we're trying to do is more than that, and it's different than that, and it supports a much larger community that extends far beyond even the albums that we sell or stream. It extends into the live business and record stores and record pressing plants, and there's really this long chain of people who benefit from artists making records and us putting them out. And so we really want to put that out there, do that research, and allow people to use it to hopefully make decisions.
There's one line on your website I really enjoyed, which is, recognizing and investing in music can do much more than deliver revenue for the industrial machine that fuels it. So this seems to say that Orca is trying to change the perception of music from an avenue of entertainment to a utility, to an actual economic and social good.
Right.
Can you talk to us a little about that line and what it kind of means for you personally?
Yeah, I mean, what it means for me is really just, it's kind of the ecosystem I was talking about, but that it's such a bigger picture. And I first learned this when I, right out of college, I got a job at a record store because I didn't want to get a real job and still feel like, in a good way, I don't have a real job. This was in the mid-90s, and, you know, I had bought records all my life. I was super into music. It wasn't new to me, but working in a record store, suddenly I realized, oh, there are these trade magazines that call me and ask me about sales, and they print these reports, and I look at these every week, and there are these people that come in from record labels, and they bring me posters and they offer me tickets to concerts and they do all these things. And there's, you know, these promo CDs that come in. I just, in real time and in real life, suddenly got this crash course in the fact that the music industry was so much more than band, recording studio, go play shows. That there, I mean, in my small world then, hundreds of people who benefited from it, who were part of it, and who also gave back to it. There, you know, I got to meet all these other people from the record labels that I didn't work with, but people who were radio promoters, and of course, A&R people, the dream job, the people who got to fly around and sign bands. And so all these things existed, and I never realized that. And I think we're kind of at a time where people think that's a thing of the past. And while that exact version of it might be a thing of the past, there are still so many more people involved and so many jobs involved and so many economics involved. And it's so beneficial to so many people. And that's really what we want to get across.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, I know plenty of people with high-flying A&R jobs still. So
that's good to hear.
Now, when we talk about investing in music, again, this is based off of some of the data and reports that are already on the ORCA website. It talks about things like workforce development, building equity. You mentioned, you know, just how far the music economy stretches into public domain, right? Whether mm-hmm. it's job creation, radios, nightlife, that's a big one.
Right.
All of these circles are interconnected. So what does investing in music mean for you? Does it mean creating more jobs? Does it mean, you know, creating more collectively owned enterprises? Do you have a specific kind of utopia in mind when you see an ideal music first society or economy?
That's interesting. I mean, there are two things that come to mind kind of to I think where you're going with your question is creating jobs, of course. I mean, there have to be people that work on this. There are people who make videos. I mean, our office alone is about 70 people in New York in the US. And it was about 40 when I started 15 years ago. So obviously it's almost doubled and a lot of jobs have changed and we've added things, but it's exciting to have new people and people of various ages who do different things and sort of adjust as the industry grows and changes. So that's one part of it. But to me, the big part of investing and the thing I think as independent labels we really talk about and focus on is investing in artists. And that means in the most simple sense, signing an artist, someone who we want to work with and they want to work with us, paying them in advance, saying, here is some money, them making a record, doing all the things that get it to the point where all the people I was just talking about can then engage and put it out and try to get it out into the world. That's really the investment. And in doing so, it's a risk. And I think a lot of people don't realize that either. No matter what, there's sort of this lore out there that like, oh, well, if a record label gets behind a record and spends money, it's going to work. It's going to be a hit. It's just money. And that's almost never been true, but it certainly is less true now maybe than ever because the sort of more manipulable avenues like radio and things are really changing and so much more democratic and people can really curate and choose what they listen to. And these are all great things. But it takes a lot of people to get something out into the world. And sometimes we spend a lot of money and it doesn't work. And that's disappointing. It's disappointing for us and for the artist, of course, financially, but also emotionally. But when it does work, that's also great and really exciting. And that's the risk. Some are going to work, some aren't. Of course, we hope to be overall on the upside so that we can keep doing it. But that's really the risk is putting out, you know, for Beggars Group, 40-ish albums a year, which is a fair amount. And some indies put out more than that, some put out less, but trying to keep afloat and keep that going in a kind of economy and society that's gotten harder to do so.
Quick question before we move on. Which part of the economy do you think is the most troublesome process for you guys? You put out a record. Is it the streaming economy that gives you the most issues? Is it the vinyl industry? I'm curious to know which cog in the entire release trajectory kind of creates either the financial issues or just some kind of roadblock.
Right.
I mean, you mentioned radio.
Right.
That's obviously an important one.
It's funny. It's not the same for maybe not any two records, but it's not the same for every record, meaning if we spend a lot of money on radio on one record, certainly that might be the problem, that it didn't yield the results we wanted and we overspent on it. That's happened, but we don't do that too often. Streaming, look, of course, like everybody, we wish we could get more money per stream, more money per play, all that stuff. But the flip side of that is that a lot more people are listening and that it adds up over time. So it doesn't not work. It just doesn't work, I think, as well as we would like it to. And as well as, of course, many artists would like it to. Vinyl, sure, sometimes you press too much or sometimes you lose a bunch in a shipment or you have damaged corners. Like, really, these, like, problems that have existed since for 100 years still exist, where there'll be a box that comes, the whole corner is banged up, and you know, there's a myriad of problems and of things that can go wrong. That's all part of this risk, and we're in the business of that. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying these are the things that can go wrong, and our job is to manage that and to stay on top of it and hopefully make it work.
Touring is another huge issue, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like anyone's making money on tour, regardless if you're a band or if you're a solo artist.
It's really crazy. I mean, before the pandemic, the joke sort of used to be, oh, we should just be booking agents. That looks like such an easy job. And I mean, I have good friends who are booking agents, and it was kind of a joke. I know it's not easy. But during the pandemic, we saw pretty quickly, obviously, that business shut down overnight for a couple of years. And when it came back, at first, it was really exciting. Everything was selling out, seemingly, for a few months or for a very short period of time. People were excited. People had not been spending money and wanted to go out. But then it got to the point where I think so many things happened. Brexit is part of it. Touring Europe is brutal, getting from country to country. There are artists who I know who had a tour booked, and by the time it came, the finances had changed so much just based on actual economics that they canceled the tour because they realized instead of making what they thought they were going to make, they were going to lose $20,000. Like, things like that actually happen. So you're seeing shows get canceled. Like you said, you're seeing full tours get canceled. You're seeing festivals get canceled. And at the same time, on the flip side, there's this crazy thing where there are lots of artists selling tons of tickets for tons of money, and that might be affecting the middle and the sort of lower end of things. And I'm not in the touring business, but of course we're close to it because we work with hundreds of artists who tour, many of whom make a big part of their living from touring. So it is definitely a hard thing right now.
Absolutely.
And that is, of course, something that, even though it doesn't directly benefit us, that would be amazing if some of these policymakers and government agencies would step in and help with.
Yeah, and that's something you mentioned in the research paper. So talk to us about the first research paper that ARCA has put out.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest takeaway for me and the most important thing is that music matters and it's valuable. And as much as that sounds almost silly for me to say and maybe silly for you to hear, I think there are people out there, again, people who are not in music, who don't necessarily, they don't disagree with that. They just don't think about it. Music is something that's just there. You turn on your radio or you turn on your phone or you do whatever. It's there. It's free. It just comes from wherever it comes from. They don't realize how much it costs, how much effort goes into it, how many human hours go into that song they're hearing. And we want them to. We think they should. And beyond that, of course, it's all the influence on local communities, on larger communities. Just it's a very important thing that many people really take for granted. And so that's a big part of it, especially for me personally. And so the paper gets into that. But the funniest thing about the paper, there's this, the report, I'm calling it a paper, same thing. There are, I think, you know, one or two of us from every label kind of in the Google Doc just making tons of comments, which was a really crazy process with that many people. And it's a pretty long report. And what was so funny to me was we kept coming back to, this isn't for the music industry. So all these words, like, you know, when we pay an artist advance, it'd be like, what's an advance? We have to spell out everything that we talk about every day and take for granted and never have to explain. We really need to explain this. So in a way, I think it was a really good exercise for us and for all the labels to go in and really have be forced to break down in the most simple terms what it is we think we do and how to tell someone. It's like that exercise when you're a kid and like the alien comes from space and you have to tell them how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It kind of, do you know that one?
Anyway, I'm not sure. Play this game.
Yeah.
But maybe I should.
Yeah, it's like that. It's like, open the peanut butter, and the teacher's like, what's peanut butter?
Oh.
But that's kind of what it felt like, was really like, all these terms that we're used to, these people won't know. Break it down in a way that they'll understand and that they can hopefully relate to.
What's interesting about the timing of ARCA's launch and, you know, this report is that it actually comes at a time, I think, when the private sector is especially paying attention to music. This is something I write a lot about at work. I mean, the influx of private equity money that has come into our very niche world of underground music has been staggering.
Seemingly out of nowhere, right?
And it's, it's that post-pandemic growth, you know, that a lot of investors want to capitalize on. They see younger people taking out credit cards to buy a ticket for a music festival. Mm. That to them, you know, is like huge dollar signs. They see someone like Fred again selling out Madison Square Garden.
Right.
That's huge. Mm-hmm. So from an investor's point of view, I think they understand the value of music in a very numbers.
Right. Not quite in the emotional way that we want,
sure.
but sure, not in some way. Yeah.
Is that a good sign for you? Does that fit with Orca's kind of mission to advance the value of music?
I mean, VC money and all that stuff is not, it's not a bad sign. And it's great that there are people investing in music, no matter what it is, no matter how they're doing it. But it does, you know, it feels, at times it feels a bit of the moment, if that makes sense. And I worry that if it, you know, like any business, if it doesn't go the way that they want to, they'll be on to the next thing. But the reason, a lot of the reason that's happening is because with streaming, the people who are making money, the income is so sort of steady and reliable. When something starts streaming, it streams about the same amount for a long time. It can go up, it can go down, but you know, it doesn't go to zero one day and go to a million the next day. It's very steady. And people with money like things like that. And they like things like that over time and when they grow. And that's what streaming has been for the last several years. So in a way, it's a fairly safe, reliable investment. And music happens to be the thing that's streaming. And so, sure, that's good. But I don't think that's not the end result. I think that's seeing it more like the stock market, not like something culturally significant and important like we see.
So that sounds more like a role for governments, right? I mean, if you can get music to be recognized as the cultural commodity as it should be and get governments to understand how it, you know, can increase their city's GDP, and same argument for nightlife, right? Like mm-hmm. so many nightmares around the world are trying to do exactly this, to get better laws for nightlife, get better funding, all because they're trying to convince, you know, the government that this is an industry in itself, full of job creation, mm-hmm. and should have its own support. What is, I guess, the goal Orca hopes to do with producing all this research? Does it want to get better laws for music? Does it want to get more public funding, more corporate funding? What's kind of the ideal scenario?
I think it's all of the above, and there's not a specific, we're not going after one thing, but everything you just said is, of course, been mentioned, and all of those would be great. We want musicians to be in a better position to do what they do, and we want people like us to be in a better position to help them. And luckily, we are in a good position, and our label and many of the labels in this group, this organization, are doing quite well, and that's really exciting, and it's great. We want to continue to do that, and we would love support to do so. And I mean, there's so many interesting things happening. I don't know if this is happening. Maybe you do. You've probably reported on it. In England, I'm hearing about a live thing where, you know, some huge stadium show, $1 mm-hmm. from every ticket. Did Coldplay just do this? $1 from every ticket or £1 goes to fund smaller clubs or
Absolutely.
Smaller venues or smaller shows. Somehow the money from the big show mm-hmm. literally trickles right into the small show.
Are those kind of ventures something that Orca would like to see happen kind of more globally?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's when I think about it, I mean, Coldplay is a great example of, you know, playing huge stadiums, playing Wembley or whatever. Mm-hmm. Wembley
yeah,
Stadium,
Wembley.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Multiple nights. I mean, I saw them at a club in Seattle. The thing that I think, and that is something, information we can obviously provide, but the kind of things, the kind of context we can help provide, that lots of people can help provide, is that they came from somewhere. Everybody came from somewhere. The small band could easily be the big band in 2 years or 10 years or 20 years or whatever it is. And in many cases, they are. Most artists start out that way. Very few rocket immediately. It happens. But, you know, we work with artists who have long careers and will hopefully get there. And it's important for policymakers and the people I keep talking about to see that and realize that they might not have seen Coldplay in a teeny club, but they were there and maybe their friends did. And that is the ecosystem we're trying to paint a picture of.
So would you say Orca's focus is strictly on putting out research, or is there a lobbying element? Are you trying to meet with these policymakers to kind of enact action, or do you want the research to speak for itself?
We're currently, the plan is just for the research to speak for itself. We're not, I don't know any policymakers myself, and I don't want to say
on,
I don't want to know any, but
you're a pretty famous guy.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's really to do, we are in a good, unique position to provide tons of data from a very interesting group of perspectives. And that's what we think is valuable, is the information that we have internally and devoting the time and resources to getting that information to the people who can then do something meaningful with it. That's really the thing.
Now, when we talk about data, are you talking about just kind of the real world businesses that all you and the other labels run? Are we talking about data about, you know, how much money an independent label makes, or how much it costs to break through a new artist, like that, those kind of real world statistics?
I think, yeah, all of the above, all the real world stuff. I think, I mean, I would love to see, and this is something we're currently talking about, I'm not withholding report too. I don't think we definitely know what it is yet. There's lots of emails and lots of us talking about what kind of data we want to look at and what we want to contribute to this report. But I would love to see a record from the moment a band gets signed to everything that happens in the studio to, but, and there, that exists. You know, there's a famous Steve Albini article about the band who signed to a major label and got screwed and would have made more working at a McDonald's or whatever. And that's great. But the economic impact that happens once that record comes out, or mm-hmm. when it's about to come out, touring money, the pressing of the vinyl, the radio staff, all of the things that happen as a result of this record existing, that's the stuff that's really interesting. Because it's not just the record, the money that the label gets from selling the record and passes on to the artist. It's all the other income streams that we don't participate in that happen as a result of the record coming out. That's what I find really interesting as part of the process. And I think that's interesting and worthy of looking at, even on a very small record, even on an artist that doesn't sell a lot of records, there's still a ripple effect.
Yeah, tracking that kind of, you know, the economic domino effect will be extremely useful. How do you plan to get the research to them and kind of make the case of still how urgent the situation is?
That's where we work with the trade organizations that the labels are members of, A2IM in the US, WIN and Impala, these great organizations that are global that do have relationships in America and internationally with policymakers and governments. And that's why we're not trying to step in and do what they already have established. We're trying to just provide them with more information.
Is there a specific, just staying on the topic of governments, is there a specific law that you would like to see in place that might benefit small independent labels or artists?
Huh.
Anything that just in your own experience of running labels you've come across that you were like, oh, I wish we had this?
It's weird. Not really. This does not come from a poor us perspective. This is not the major labels are doing this and that's hurting our business. The major labels are great at what they do. And that's, you know, that's just another world. It's another thing. So we're not here saying we're really being hurt by this system. Please help us. It's really the opposite. It's, we're doing really well. Here's how we're doing well. We would like to do better and help more artists do better.
I read a statistic the other day that said 80% of music used in media today is stock.
Wow.
That's, you know,
terrible.
That's terrible. Absolutely. If you're an underground artist, you could fulfill that need. But yeah.
Even an overground artist would be better than stock. Yeah.
Something that right. isn't AI generated, right? And the problem seems to be just complete inefficiencies in the system. So with licensing, apparently it's, you know, if you're an advertiser or a filmmaker or any kind of part of a production crew, finding music that suits your budget and timeline is apparently very hard.
And a lot of the time it is the budget. And to be fair, certainly it's the size of the artist. The artist is always involved, at least with Beggars, in these decisions. We wouldn't just go put something in a commercial. We can't contractually. But, you know, we want to get paid for those things and we want the artist to get paid. And so it's rarely do we see the like, ah, oh, it's great promotion. Let's just do it really cheap. That's just not who we are. That we think, again, the whole thesis here is that music has value. And when there's a company with money doing something, it's, you know, sometimes it'll be at the end of a film with a huge budget and they'll say, you know, we really don't have any money left for music, but we really want to use the song. And it's like, how do we get those people to think of music earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Would they ever say we don't have money to do the edit? No, because the edit's really important to the movie. So is the music.
Can you talk to us about some of the plans Orca has made just going forward? Is there another research report coming out? And if so, how will that report be different from the one that's already out there? Any kind of events maybe Orca's planning to kind of, you know, bring this message out to a larger number of people?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been that long. I mean, there's one research paper out. We're working on the second one. And, you know, again, I don't know exactly what it'll be, but I do think it'll be more project-based, more here are a few examples of putting out a record, where it goes, the long tail, how the money is distributed, the various people that benefit from it, the sort of more wide-reaching effects. But there's not a super long-term goal. I mean, it's an interesting group of people who are very busy. We've only gotten together in person once in New York and once in London, and that's it. And there are people, you know, there are labels from Germany and Canada and the US and all over the globe. So it's not an easy thing to do. So my goal would be to get together for a third time in person and actually sit down and just get a lot more done and hash some things out. But there's definitely at least one or two more reports coming, and we're kind of figuring that out.
You know, what's interesting is that you said at the beginning of this conversation that you didn't intend for the research to be for the music industry. Mm. But I actually think it would be hugely beneficial for people working in music to know about, yeah, this cultural and economic footprint. So when you have other labels and kind of other artists reading this report, is there maybe a takeaway you'd want your own kind of music industry colleagues to come away with, like to maybe improve their own practices? I'm just trying to figure out what if there's a lesson for people working in music.
I think, I mean, almost to what I just said, I think, you know, people at labels big and small to realize the ripple effect, to realize that even if you're a one-person label putting out your friend's record, it's still more than benefiting just that one person, that there are things that happen, things that you don't see and things you don't hear about. And that's, I think that's important for all of us to know.
Absolutely. A lot of food for thought.
A lot.
Thank you, Nabil, for chatting with us and talking to us about Orca.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Aria Exchange. The song playing in the outro is My Little Tony by Bar Italia, a band that's released on Beggars Group. If you liked what you heard, please check out other episodes of The Aria Exchange. You can dig through our archives on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, on our website, or wherever you listen to audio. And I would also genuinely love to hear from you about the issues you want to hear covered, the artists you want to see interviewed. Drop us a line at exchange@ra.co and share your thoughts. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next week. I turn to see where you are. You had to stay in your part and you go. I waited for you. Same decision, so misunderstood. Missed the chance, I always said you would. You don't feel it when you know you should. There's no running.